Good morning. I hope you're sitting comfortably, as they say at the BBC. BBC imbroglio with Trump will be discussed not very lengthily with Jelani Cobb. There was an extra, quite a long one. I'll let you go find his autobiographical material that goes into in pretty detail at the end of the segment. Oh, by the way, I'm Paul Muth. This is WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. I've been having a wrangle about the BBC. There's a group out there that are trying to conflate the resignations with their coverage of Gaza and Israel-Palestine, which is rubbish. There are critiques to be made. There are actually some critiques to be made internally, saying that coverage is actually much too pro-Israel. There's been a campaign to get a BBC board member off who's explicitly tied to Israel. So there's a lot that's not reported. Very little reported on the 100 employees that signed documents saying that they were critical of the reporting, giving instances. And there's a broad content analysis, which basically shows the same thing. But that's from an Arab source, so it's dismissed out of hand. Let's do an underwriting announcement and do some business. Haven't done the car donation in a while. I'm still working on one of those. CarEasy.com, 855-500-RIDE. You can go to the WEFT website and find out other information. Why don't I do that cultural announcement? Pete Shungu has a CD release, album release, I guess they call them. I don't know if they're going to have concrete. Yeah, probably have a CD. He plays with a lot of different groups, but he's under his own name, and he's got Rene Balakita. He's Congolese extraction, and so Jean-René Balakita is going to do a song or two. And there's one rap song that's done in both Spanish and French, Superpoder in Spanish, Superpower. I'll be intrigued to hear what that one's about. I think this one's on the list, isn't it? As far as playing underwriting announcements, here's a local group, I guess I'll say.
Programming on WEFD is brought to you in part by ShampanaEats.com. Champaign-Urbana's only publication highlighting the food and drink scene in Champaign and Urbana. Champana Eats brings you behind the scenes of the local food industry. Who, how, where, and what you choose to eat next. ShampanaEats.com.
Okay, just checking at the last minute to see if Mumi Abu Jamal has dropped a new commentary, and he hasn't. I'm hoping his health is okay and he's getting the medical attention. Fair and Accuracy in Reporting has an interesting interview with him, as well as in the while past have done an explainer of the case. No gunshot residue tests on his hands. Racist judge, court reporter, or court note taker overheard. So this is a person who's bonded, said that he's wanted to fry the N-word. Okay, I didn't put that in pause, did I? We're going to then start with Amy Goodman's commentary. I believe she had something about the seating of Grijalva. I'm not saying it right. The representative from Arizona, whose constituency was unrepresented. Of course, they weren't doing anything, but she still was barred from putting her office in and doing constituent services for 60 days or so. The consent decree or discharge petition, I keep confusing the two. Nothing related to each other. They're both legal terms, I guess. Will now probably go ahead sooner than thought. Sam Husseini's on board with the Epstein update, I guess. This was recorded the 13th of November, so might incorporate some of the new things. It's actually in a segment that he and Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints does called Genocide Watch. It's on Mondays, so I commend your attention to it. But this time they got together on Thursday. I guess they were preempted on Monday for special programming. So it works in the behalf. I started at the top about talking about Johnny Cobb. I really don't know his work, but it's an interesting interview, and it does touch upon the attack on the media. He doesn't have the up-to-date material on the BBC. It's on the November the 10th. There's BBC's posting something every 2 or 3 hours about this supposed lawsuit for $5 billion defamation. In what court? I don't know. ICJ? He doesn't recognize that. That's all right. Let's kick it with the Amy Goodman piece, and then we'll get to Jelani Cobb, and then Flashpoints with Sam Husseini. That's the rundown. I'm a little run down. I don't know quite what it is. Doctor's appointment too early on yesterday morning took me out of off my game. Maybe I should. Well, never enough. Enough about me. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And this should be Amy Goodman. Get to with the Jelani Cobb interview pretty straight away right after that. Maybe I'll interject something.
Later. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Adelita Grijalva was finally sworn in to the U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday after being blocked from her duly elected role by Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson for 50 days, denying congressional representation to Grijalva's 800,000-plus constituents in southern Arizona. Johnson, it seemed, was far more interested in serving the interests of just one man, namely President Donald Trump. By refusing to swear in Grijalva, Johnson was able to block the long-pending discharge petition that would force a vote on releasing the government's files on the late convicted child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Well, Johnson's delays are over. Adelita Grijalva is now a member of Congress, and as her first official act, she signed the discharge petition. This allows an end run around the speaker, who sets the agenda in the House of Representatives and decides what comes to a vote and what doesn't. There will now be a vote in the House to compel the Justice Department to make public its full trove of Epstein files. The bill is expected to pass in the House, although its fate in the Senate is unclear. Adelita Grijalva raised the Epstein files in her first floor speech, which she delivered after receiving a rousing standing ovation from her congressional colleagues.
Our democracy only works when everyone has a voice. This includes the millions of people across the country who have experienced violence and exploitation, including Liz Stein and Jessica Michaels, both survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse. They are here in the gallery with us this evening. Thank you for being here. Just this morning, House Democrats released more emails showing that Trump knew more about Epstein's abuses than he previously acknowledged.
Grijalva continued.
It's past time for Congress to restore its role as a check and balance on this administration and fight for we, the American people. We need to fight for our immigrant communities and veterans. We need to stand up for our public schools, children, and educators. We need to respect tribal sovereignty in our environment. We need to stand up for LGBTQ plus rights, because that's what the American people expect us to do. Fight for them. That is why I will sign the discharge petition right now to release the Epstein files.
Grijalva won the special election to fill the seat left vacant by the death of her father, the late Congressmember Raul Grijalva. She opened her speech paying tribute to him and to her heritage.
I rise today the proud granddaughter of a bracero, a hardworking Mexican immigrant who came to this country for a better life. And I stand as the proud daughter of a U.S. congressman, a man who spent his entire life fighting for justice, equity, and dignity for the most vulnerable.
Grijalva thanked her constituents.
Thank you to La Gente of Southern Arizona for making history, electing me, the first Latina, the first Chicana from Arizona to ever go to Congress.
And then she spoke in Spanish.
Este momento es histórico para nuestra comunidad. Es un honor ser la primera Latina en representar a Arizona en el Congreso. Y les aseguro que aunque soy la primera, no será la última.
She said, this is a historic moment for our community. It's an honor to be the first Latina to represent Arizona in Congress. And I'm certain that although I'm the first, I will not be the last. Speaking on Democracy Now! On her first full day in Congress, Representative Grijalva explained her choice to speak in Spanish as well as English in her first House address.
I felt it very important. In Southern Arizona, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking families and even many that are bilingual. And so I wanted to let them know that I was there for them.
Adelita is a name known to many in the border region as the name of a famous corrido, or ballad, of the Mexican Revolution called La Adelita. In the early years of the 20th century, the Mexican people rose up against the long-standing dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz. While the song's lyrics cast the revolutionary struggle in romantic terms, it's come to symbolize the central role women played in the revolution's ultimate success. House Speaker Johnson's arbitrary and hostile refusal to swear in Adelita Grijalva for close to 2 months was an absolute disservice not only to her and her constituents, but to our democracy. As fears rise of Trump's authoritarian actions, the people of Southern Arizona now have a voice in Congress. Adelante, Adelita. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That'll push some buttons. Okay, I meant to mention at the top that, Sam Hussein will be talking about the Epstein implications, Mossad connections, maybe the money laundering aspect that's getting short shrift too, though I thought it was mentioned in some discourse recently. And I know that Senator from Oregon, whose name is escaping me, is particularly focusing on the huge amounts of cash transfers. There's one story that, that Epstein and Trump actually fell out over going after a certain property in Florida that eventually Trump did successfully buy and then flipped for like 1.5 times the money he paid for it to a Russian oligarch, which is the way that money laundering happens through property sales. So, there's a lot of discourse there. A guy named James Henry of the, I guess he's with Global, he's with a New York University anyway. I played a bit of him talking about how many illicit over the allotted amount of to be reported transfers happened inside of Chase through Epstein. So I want to have that mentioned here at the top. Amy Goodman had Jeremy Scahill's relatively new group called Dropbox Site, had somebody on talking about the series they're doing on that, which I haven't traced down yet, but I mean to. But here's a relaxed discussion with Jelani Cobb. I don't know much about his work, but they talk a lot about Debs. They talk about his position at Columbia during Mahmoud Khalil's abduction. And talk about the climate in the university there, and also about the strong-arming of media groups that Trump's been doing and now is taking it to an international scale by threatening a $5 billion defamation suit. Now, if my argument is that if they had just acknowledged that there was a clip, you know, that they cut two clips together, if they'd had just a fade or something, that would have that it did actually convey what Trump was calling for, which was a violent overturning of the election. So, yeah. He said some noise about, you know, this is January 6th and all that. That's the root of what the suit is about. So, what court, indeed, as I said earlier. Here's Amy Goodman in conversation. Again, I think the next reporting she'll be doing is from Brazil this coming week. It wraps up midweek unless it extends, and she'll be down there at least for a couple of days.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Jelani Cobb, acclaimed historian, dean of the Columbia Journalism School, and a staff writer at The New Yorker, his book is just out. It's called Three or More is a Riot, Notes on How We Got Here, a 437-page collection of his essays from 2012 to 2025, with a bunch of postscripts. I asked you about the subtitle, How We Got Here, in part one of our conversation. What about Three or More is a Riot?
That title came to me when I was in Charleston and I was reporting on the trial of Dylann Roof, you know, the white supremacist who killed 9 people in the church, Emmanuel AME. And it reminded me that in 1739, there had been a slave revolt, the Stonewall Revolt in South Carolina. And in the wake of that slave revolt, the colonial legislature passed a law that said the definition, effectively the definition of a slave revolt, was 3 or more Negroes, as they would have been called then, outside the presence of a white man. So this mere gathering of 3 people meant that this was forbidden. And it spoke to the kind of demographic anxiety of that era. And when I looked at what was happening there, what was the animating force behind Trumpism, you know, what was the animating force behind, you know, so much of that what we were seeing in American politics, it went back to that same sort of demographic anxiety. And so that's where the title came from, and it's Three or More is a Riot.
And I meant to interject that I'm consumed with how Ken Burns is going to convey the American Revolution. What I've heard is that it's going to be long on reenactment and exotic drone portrayals, video, and perhaps shorter on analysis than it should be. I'm trying to get somebody to take a wager with me on whether the Somerset case will be mentioned at all. I've watched a little bit of his explaining it, and I think it's going to be, I can't think of the right word. Whitewash comes to mind. There are complexities. I don't oppose the revolution, but I'm very influenced by Gerald Horn's Negro Comrades of the Crown about the slaves that fought on the British side, and the later book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, where he says the UK is turning away from slavery, mostly for strategic purposes, was dismaying to the colonialists, and it was one of the main things that motivated them, as well as the territorial changes that the Quebec Act made in undercutting the land claims that George Washington and other Virginians had made through territory all the way to the Ohio River. Anyway, sorry for the interjection. Here's Jelani Cobb.
I want to turn to what's going on right now, what some are calling a MAGA civil war, generated by an interview former Fox News host Tucker Carlson did with the white nationalist influencer Nick Fuentes, a Holocaust denier who praised Hitler many times, had dinner with Trump in Mar-a-Lago in 2022, well-known as a white nationalist, as an anti-Semite, as a racist. Among his comments, and I could choose one of hundreds, a bastardized Jewish subversion of the American creed. The founders never intended for America to be a refugee camp for non-white people. If you can talk about what's happening here, the attack is that the head of the Heritage Foundation has supported Tucker Carlson in a very sympathetic interview with Nick Fuentes, what this white Christian nationalist movement represents.
So, I mean, I think there are a lot of things. If you actually look at the history of the Heritage Foundation, it kind of mirrors the Republican Party, because I'm old enough to remember when the Heritage Foundation was, I mean, it was right of center. It was a right of center think tank, but it was nowhere near, they would not have come anywhere near the kind of xenophobic, anti-Semitic, overtly racist, Nazi-sympathizing kinds of politic that we see now. And it's kind of similarly with the mainline GOP. But what really is the conflict here is that this goes all the way back to Charlottesville. There's always been, this attachment from the earliest point of, Trump's emergence. There's always been this attachment of this neo-Confederate, neo-Nazi element that has strongly and visibly been supportive of him. The problem is that, they're in the midst of their own culture war, in which they have accused, the left of being the primary purveyors of anti-Semitism via any criticism they have for Benjamin Netanyahu, any criticism they have for the waging of war in Gaza, for what very many people have referred to as genocide, all these things that are happening. And so it gets in the way and it becomes a bit of an embarrassment if you are making great political hay by flogging the left for these sins. And at the same time, you have in your camp people who are overtly sympathizing with a person who oversaw the mass execution of 6 million Jews.
And then where J.D. Vance fits into this picture, for example, the whole controversy around the text conversations of the white Republicans who referred to African-Americans right. as animals, right. talked a great deal about their sympathy with Hitler, while some of them were forced out of their positions. One of them left, who was an elected official in Vermont, not so young, by the way.
Right.
You had J.D. Vance actually making a statement about stop the pearl clutching.
Right. Yeah, he did. He said that. He also, the same person who spoke in defense of the far right in Germany, specifically went to Germany to advocate on behalf of the far right. You can't get a more leaden symbol than that. And so this is, a kind of playing footsie with these people and wanting to have, for the portion of their electorate that still blanches at this kind of thing, they still want to have plausible deniability. But they've gone further and further and further. Immigrants poisoning the American bloodstream, all these things that we have seen that are kind of standard textbook fascistic language and that tend to preface some sort of mass violence directed at vulnerable populations. And we've seen that become an increasingly prominent part of their rhetoric.
Let's talk about what happened here in New York, which has really shaken the foundations of
sure.
the establishment all over the country. And I'm not just talking about the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party as well. And that is the election of the Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani, winning the New York mayoral race over the disgraced former Governor Andrew Cuomo. Yes, New York will soon have its first Muslim mayor, first South Asian mayor, and the youngest mayor in over a century. This is part of what Mamdani said on election night.
The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity.
That was Zohran Mamdani on mm-hmm. election night. If you can talk about the significance of his victory as he was introduced to 1,000 supporters and organizers, and that's a really key point of every hue, were there at the theater where he spoke, where he was celebrating his victory. Over 104,000 volunteers mm-hmm. went out through the five boroughs, and a number of them were actual organizers working for all of these months to get Zohran Mamdani, the 34-year-old, now mayor-elect of New York, elected.
It's really amazing. First off, that quote from Eugene Debs is, you know, particularly if we wanted to play, you know, a probably interesting trivia game, like go back and find the last time that an American elected official quoted Eugene Debs. It will not be any time within, you know, it was recent. It's certainly not quoting him favorably. But the other thing that I think is significant here is that Debs, who really was the kind of avatar of American socialism for the moment that he existed in, was also dealing with a point at which the United States population had grown tremendously, largely by immigrants, driven by immigrants, and had been kind of advocating for a socialism that was both tolerant and inclusive, and also looking at the common interests of all of these working people. And so, you know, the quote for Debs, for a Democratic Socialist mayor-elect, probably could not be more apropos. The other thing that I think about it, and, you know, my colleague at Columbia, Basil Smichel, made a really good observation, is that Mamdani has put together, and the team around him has put together, this really broad array of New Yorkers around American, around kind of common interests, common economic interests, and the idea of there being a city that's more affordable, et cetera. It's a counterpoint, and it kind of harkens back to what we heard David Dinkins say in his rhetoric back in 1989 when he was elected as mayor, kind of famously referred to the gorgeous mosaic of the city. With Mamdani, I think it becomes an even more pointed observation about bringing all of these different communities together, because it is a direct counterpoint to what we see in our national politics. And of course, Mamdani being an assemblyman from Queens, and his primary kind of target in that speech, or the person who he has the most pointed criticism from, is directed toward, is a president who is in fact from Queens too. And you know, this is a internal conversation, Queens being the most diverse county in the United States. And this is a president who despises that dynamic and a mayor-elect who embodies it. And I think that's the subtext that we're thinking about in this conversation.
Now, of course, Bernie Sanders endorsed him, sure, as did AOC. And in Bernie Sanders' book, It's OK to Be Angry About Capitalism, he, too, quotes Eugene Victor Debs, mm-hmm, Eugene V. Debs, who says the vast majority of Americans recognize that Eugene Victor Debs was right when he said a century ago, quote, I'm opposing a social order in which it's possible for one man who does absolutely nothing that is useful to amass a fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars, while millions of men and women who work all the days of their lives secure barely enough for a wretched existence.
That's right.
And we happen to be speaking, Jelani, right at the moment where the USDA, the Trump administration, is threatening any state who That's dares right. to fill the gap right. To fully fund food stamps, SNAP, right. for what? I think it's 1 in 8 Americans rely on SNAP
right.
to eat.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so there's that. And then there's the other side. You know, it's the hand that taketh and the hand that giveth, because of the extraordinarily lenient and beneficial policies that have been directed at the upper 1% of the 1%, and the kind of vast accumulation of wealth that's happening on the other side of it. And so I think that, you know, one of the other things I'll say just really quickly about Mamdani is that it was interesting to hear the criticism that, you know, if he were elected, the moneyed class was going to flee the city, or that they were going to react in this kind of way. It reminded me of when the NYPD was angry with de Blasio and they decided that they were not going to enforce laws, but that, without realizing that this was exactly what people had been saying, that they had been over aggressive in enforcing particular kinds of laws. So it was like, you're going to punish me by giving me the thing that I have in fact asked for. And that's not to say that kind of people are supposed to leave the city, you know, kind of flee or any of these other kinds of things, but it is to say that people made the calculation that, you know, the rent is incredibly you know, unaffordable for people. The subway system, which is our most democratic form of transportation, is severely lacking. You know, wages stagnate. All of these things that are happening. And we have had years of policies that favored the moneyed classes. And so what will happen if we don't have those policies anymore? Like, the things that people are worried about happening are already happening. And so I think that was one of the kind of more notable things, you know, rhetorically, at least in that campaign.
I wanted to ask you about this latest BBC headline, but mm-hmm. go broader than that to what's happening right here at home with the media. And you certainly comment on the media all the time. You follow it very closely. You have the top executives at the BBC abruptly resigning following mm-hmm. backlash over the BBC's edit of a speech made by President Trump January 6th of 2021 before a mob of his supporters. The BBC is reportedly planning to formally apologize to Trump, who celebrated the resignation, saying on Truth Social, "These are very dishonest people who tried to step on the scales of a presidential election. What a terrible thing for democracy." Trump repeatedly has defended unfounded claims that his 2020 loss to Joe Biden was rigged. So you have the BBC top people resigning. You have both CBS and ABC paying $15 and $16 million to President Trump. When clearly in both of those cases, in the case of CBS, is 60 Minutes editing an interview with Kamala Harris. If this case had gone to court, it is hard to believe that CBS would have lost.
Sure. So, I mean, of course, I mean, you know this probably as well better than anybody, that, you know, if you have any kind of raw material, you have this editing process that has to go. If you are even in print, you know, if you're talking to someone and they say 10 times, you know, you're not going to quote you're going to like edit that out. And so, you know, this is generally done, as they will say, done for clarity and brevity. That's what people will kind of say. And within those bounds, you know, that's a kind of normal, acceptable thing. The line about the CBS interview and the kind of editing of it, you know, to make someone's point more clear. Well, that's exactly what the point of editing is. And, you know, what I think a compelling kind of counterpoint would have been to show the history of editing Donald Trump's statements. Because, you know, if you have someone who goes and takes 5 minutes to make a point and you have 30 seconds for that segment, you're going to actually try to make the person sound more cogent. I haven't seen the specific BBC edit, so I can't comment on it. I know that, you know, there's, you know, a kind of ongoing thing about it. But I do think the administration has likely been emboldened precisely because American news organizations caved in instances where at least the media lawyers who I have been in contact with and people who I discussed these other cases with strongly felt that these were cases that would have been thrown out, that these were cases that didn't really have a whole lot of legal weight to them. And by settling them for multiple millions of dollars, you only enhance the possibility that more news organizations are going to face that same sort of dynamic. Mm.
So where do you see the media going today in this country? And what gives you hope? I mean, on the one hand, you have this fierce attack. Normally, what bullies do is they go after the weakest. But Trump is going after the most powerful, which is very efficient, because if they cave and he has to count on them caving, it creates a chilling effect for everyone. Because if he's going to go after the big boys, people who don't have those kind of resources are really afraid.
They are. But also, you know, some of the big organizations have vulnerabilities that other organizations don't, quite frankly, because the leverage that's been used against them has been their kind of corporate parentage and the desire for billion-dollar generating, you know, mergers or various other kinds of things that they want to pursue. You know, that was the case with the Washington Post and, you know, Bezos' ownership of Amazon and, you know, his space, you know, programs and all these other kinds of things. That's the case with Paramount. That's the case with all these other kinds of things. Other organizations don't necessarily have those same vulnerabilities. And I'll say that the one beneficial thing here is that the media ecosystem is still diverse. You know, not as diverse as it once was, but there's still different types of news organizations. There are people like you doing what you do. There are nonprofit newsrooms. There are all kinds of different entities that are still trying to generate, you know, a baseline of knowledge for an informed public. And that might be, you know, our saving grace, at least for the moment.
I wanted to ask you about March 8th, International Women's Day, though I don't think that was the point of what happened on that day, but it was the day that Mahmoud Khalil was arrested. Mm-hmm. This day had a tremendous effect on you as well. You were leaving to give a speech, leaving the country.
I was on my way to
London. Can you talk about what happened on that day?
So I was on my way to, on my way to JFK, and I got a message from one of the people who work in the dean's office that Mahmoud had been arrested the night before. And so
he had appealed, by the way, to the Columbia president before that, saying, "I'm really afraid. I think I might be taken. Can you help me?" Because he was in Columbia housing.
He was in Columbia housing. Now, that story is a little bit more complicated than what's known. And so the fact of it is that Columbia did not assist in his arrest. I know that for a fact, like being, you know, dean, I was part of those conversations. It did not assist and did not give access. If you notice, the people who arrested him followed someone else into the building because they were not given legal access to into the building.
I guess the question isn't so much did they help in the arrest, mm-hmm. As did they help Mahmoud Khalil when he asked them to help, because he knew that they were closing in on him and he was a student.
Yeah, I think that if you were to talk to various other kinds of people in the administration, their version of this was that they didn't give, there was no information given about his whereabouts. There was no access granted to, you know, his housing or any of those things. Aside from that, it's kind of hard to imagine like what is in the university's purview. But that was something that I knew as being a dean, that was part of the I was privy to the conversations surrounding that. But the other part of it was that I was about I was supposed to be in London for 5 days for different events, for a conference, for a talk.
You were giving a speech.
I was giving a speech at Oxford, and so I decided that I would go. I would give the speech. I would still keep the thing. I didn't want to cancel that event. But as soon as I gave the speech, I would then hop on a plane and come back. And that was what kind of how we proceeded. Then we had kind of internal conversations. We talked with our alumni. We talked with our attorneys. We talked with all these other constituencies about what our students needed to know, what our international students needed to know, what were the vulnerabilities that we had, what were the protocols that we needed to follow, and we were trying to figure out what our stance would be. We then eventually, this was a little while down the line, I don't remember what the exact timeline was, but we at the journalism school put out a statement kind of pointing to Mahmoud Khalil's arrest being a tactic that would be used to stifle dissent on college campuses that would curtail the vitality of the First Amendment and academic freedom and so on. And so we put that out and we got a good bit of criticism about it that was kind of anticipated. But that was kind of how we began, to proceed and to figure out what we would do. And of course, we did what the journalism school does in a moment like that, which is that we started reporting.
Are you afraid for your international students overall? I mean, he was an international student who already then had a green card, married to an American, and was well on the way to becoming a U.S. citizen. But there are those who are even more vulnerable, although ultimately he was jailed for months.
Right.
What is the climate like?
So I think that, when I went back to that McCarthy example, one of the things that there is, a long history of, and, again, it's like my hat tip to my colleague Ellen Strecker, who's written about this extensively, is that there is a long history of using immigration law to suppress dissent in the United States, going all the way back to the Palmer Raids in 1919, 1920. But you go up through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and you find people who dissent or who have unpopular political views, and the primary tool for silencing them is to utilize immigration law. So this is not new. It's a replay of an older tactic that is fundamentally undemocratic and fundamentally contravenes any concept of the First Amendment. If you have a First Amendment that only protects you when you agree with the administration, then you don't have a First Amendment. And so I think that that is the grounds that people should look at the Mahmoud Khalil situation on, irrespective of whether you agree with him or not. It's the fundamental question of his ability to articulate a viewpoint that may be supported by some people and may be outright despised by other people, but it's still within the bounds of his right to express himself.
Mm-hmm. And then you have Hermesa Özturk at Tufts.
That's right.
Who writes an op-ed
even
in
more
her
overt,
Tufts
even more newspaper. Overt. Right. Absolutely. I mean, we could just go through the line. They're just instance after instance of this. And that's why I think it's important to kind of look and say this is a kind of habitual problem in American society with the criminalization of dissent, particularly by people who are immigrants or who have immigrant status. But it never, even if you don't care about that, it never stops there. That always is an on-ramp for stigmatizing the speech of even broader groups of people who are dissenting. And so there's that concern, too.
Interestingly, Eugene V. Debs was jailed repeatedly because there was a law passed that you could not criticize World War One.
That's right.
And that's exactly what he was doing. And he ultimately would run for president from jail.
Yeah. And what was it? He won 2 million votes or something. I forget what it was. A million votes. The astounding number of votes that he won running his presidential campaign from the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, which was, just an astounding thing.
Tell us how you became a journalist, Jelani. Actually, go back to where you were born.
And if you want to hear the biographical part of the interview, that's the last 10 minutes or so. I wasn't quite sure how long that ran with Jelani Cobbs. That was the web exclusive part of the part two. And nothing needed to be deleted this time. That Amy Goodman did, again, she's going to be in Belém, at the mouth of the Amazon, I guess, covering the climate conference, the COP 30, I guess, is what I'm supposed to remember. Beginning of the week, I think. Sam Husseini, I hope I get all of this on, so I guess I better start it. I clearly won't, but can commend your attention to the Thursday edition of Flashpoints. Also mention again that Dropsite News is doing a whole series on Epstein. This is a segment usually on Mondays. It was preempted, so it came in and with some of the latest revelations. but the dimension of money laundering, which I don't know if he mentions at all, but the intelligence connections are covered by Drop Site News. They're doing a whole series on the same. But let's join Dennis Bernstein with Sam Husseini.
For our regular edition of Genocide Watch. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoint. So I want to talk in a little bit about, Epstein and the whole Zionist Israeli movement. Now, there's a lot there. And that relationship that Epstein had with the Israelis sort of demonstrates the corruptness in terms of U.S. participation in the genocide and their willingness to work with anybody, including a child rapist. But Sam, I want to start in the West Bank. Because it really does seem like the Israelis are moving fast, expanding, the violence is getting deeper, and I thought we would start there.
Sure, Dennis. I mean, it's gotten to the point in the West Bank that I think even the mainstream is having to note it to some degree. It's that they're just wanton attacks, on a dramatically escalating basis by Israeli settlers, as, you know, Palestinians are trying to, you know, pick their olives, for olive season. So, you even had the Israeli president say it's shocking, the settler violence. But I think that this is sort of an attempt to, you know, put at arm's length something that's become so brazen. But it is a very serious thing and dramatically in attempting to intimidate and perhaps spiral to perhaps trigger an all-out conflict, an all-out assault on the West Bank. So it's kind of interesting to see even the mainstream sort of noting that at this point, but it is literally a record level of violence on the West Bank, you know, as compared to over the last several decades.
I noticed there was a really vicious attack on the Hajja Hamida Mosque. A blaze was seen for miles, and it was a blatant attack. I think that's one of those attacks that's getting international attention. That's the voice of Sam Husseini. This is Flashpoints. Sam, let's talk. Well, first of all, also, let's say something about Gaza, because clearly Israelis, they call it a ceasefire, but the fires never ceased, and it's been a real struggle to get a few extra, not extra, but a few trucks through based on what is really being held back and what's needed. It's a difficult moment.
Absolutely.
Might as well mention that.
Absolutely, Dennis. I was just in contact with, I know he's been on your show, Dr. Farwaz Shadwa, yes. And he's not able to get into Gaza. He's gotten in before, even during, you know, the full-fledged genocide, and now during a so-called ceasefire, he's not able to get in. Aid organizations have been particularly highlighting not only is there a not only are there severe restrictions still in terms of getting medical and food aid in, but there's almost a blanket prohibition about getting shelter in tents, building supplies, and so on, with the winter coming. This could be cataclysmic. You even had a report from the BBC, interestingly enough, which has been, you know, incredibly pro-Israel. You know, people might recall they were gutted in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Israel has destroyed more than 1,500 buildings in Gaza since the quote-unquote ceasefire. So Israel continues to control directly more than half of Gaza. They're in effect partitioning it, you know, sort of like what they've done with the West Bank, and of course making, you know, conditions unbearable for Palestinians, with the obvious long-term goal of continuing to ethnically cleanse. That's still clearly the goal.
That's the goal. Well, we're going to keep an eye on that. And whatever they're calling a ceasefire, it's obviously an incredibly treacherous time to be in Gaza. And now, of course, as we said, in the West Bank as well. Sam, Jeffrey Epstein is at the center of the controversy that could easily bring down the president of the United States. And you've got the holier-than-thou Democrats dying to prosecute the case. And who wouldn't want to see Trump tried for his relationship with Epstein and whatever he may have been engaged with? But you can't, the Democrats And the Democratic leadership can't really separate itself from the kinds of actions and policies that Epstein participated in to support the Zionist and expand the genocide in Palestine. So it really is a hard one for them to explain how they're sort of different when it comes to this relationship. You want to talk about Epstein in the context of what's going on in Israeli support for Israel?
I'll do the best I can, Dennis. There are several layers to this. You're right. I mean, Epstein had a very close relationship with Trump and with Clinton. I mean, he visited the Clinton White House like 17 times. So he's had extensive relationship with both sides. One thing that's interesting is how the political parties sort of switched positions on the whole Epstein disclosure question over the last year. People might recall during the last so-called election cycle, it was Republicans, including Kash Patel, who's now FBI director, and others closely associated with Trump, including members of his family, who were going on about how the deep state was keeping the Epstein files under wraps and so on. And then when Trump gets in, he's saying there's nothing to see here, including Kash Patel. So the position, and suddenly the Democrats are interested in something, the establishment Democrats are interested in something that they expressed very little interest in before. And they're trying to tie it as much as they can with Trump. I suspect they're trying to tie it to Trump without, you know, as you sort of indicated in your question, Dennis, you know, exposing the whole apple cart of how Epstein was tied not just to both parties, but to the broader elite establishment. I mean, he's closely associated with billionaires like Les Wexner, like Peter Thiel, and several others. You know, it's amazing to hear Democrats over the last couple of months talk about Jeffrey Epstein, you know, how Trump is protecting Jeffrey Epstein and his billionaire buddies, but they never name those billionaire buddies. Certainly not Les Wexner, who really put Epstein into action, buying him his, palatial largest residential home in Manhattan, for example, founder of Victoria's Secret's catalog. Now, another thing that the mainstream coverage in both political parties has stayed away from is the connection to Israel. And what was interesting is that DropSite News has gone through, that they got a trove of hacked emails, which includes stuff, material from Ehud Barak, who's a former Israeli prime minister, as well as for a time he was head of Mossad, and for a time he was their so-called defense minister, his emails with Epstein for several years. And this is sort of the nail in the coffin of anybody who was still pretending that Epstein wasn't a, I hesitate to say the word asset for the Israeli Mossad, because at points, if you read some of the interactions between Barak and Epstein, it's more Epstein giving direction to Barak rather than the other way around.
The former Israeli prime minister you're talking about, Ehud Barak, yes.
That's correct. After he left public office, he was obviously very interested in making money, he and Epstein talked about how to do business deals in, throughout Asia and elsewhere, getting meetings with Kremlin, with Putin and other Kremlin officials to try to do deals in Russia. He helped Epstein helped them do a security arrangement with Mongolia. Helped Barak and other Israeli officials sell surveillance equipment to Cote d'Ivoire in Africa. So it was several layers to this, and perhaps most significantly of the pieces that they've written. This is DropSite News off of these hacked emails. They tried to nudge Russia to get Assad out of Syria and tried to find ways of getting the U.S. to attack Iran. I think what DropSite News has done in these reports is valuable, but they almost sort of missed the forest for the trees at times, saying that this effort failed. And it did fail when it happened between the two of them 10 years ago. But the fact of the matter is that both those things eventually happened. Assad was forced out, apparently with at least Russian acquiescence. Bashar Assad ended up taking refuge in Russia. And the U.S. did eventually attack attack Iran. Trump did that earlier this year. And I should note, I think I was on your show September 31st on the Epstein stuff. People might want to look at that, because part of what happened over the summer was that the whole, that, you know, the other aspect of this is, you know, is there blackmail? Is Trump concealable, Trump and other U.S. officials and presidents and so on being blackmailed by Epstein slash Israel? So earlier this year, right around the time that Trump seemed to be making noises that he was going to, you know, tell Netanyahu that he had to calm down at his level of violence, that he had to pipe it down, you simultaneously had Elon Musk post on his platform X that Trump was in the Epstein files, and you simultaneously had the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, put out a video where he chastised Trump for not attacking Iran. That was just a whole taco thing. Trump always chickens out. So they were, it seemed to be a concerted effort to effectively push Trump to back off from forcing Netanyahu into backing off from Iran and into a ceasefire in Gaza during the summer. And he did. Trump actually backed up Israel's attack on Iran and totally backed off, at least for a time, on the entire ceasefire thing until relatively recently, about a month ago, when you had the so-called ceasefire, which I believe the U.S. and Israel were pushed to because of the pressure applied in other quarters, most obviously Colombia moving to get the General Assembly to vote for a Uniting for Peace resolution. I think that's what compelled the so-called Trump plan and the so-called ceasefire. So, you know, there are, you know, several dimensions to the Epstein story. The establishment wants to paint it I agree with you, Dennis. It'd be fine to see Trump go down, but we have to be careful that even an insidious figure like Trump, is he going down because he did something wrong, or is he going down because he might actually polarize with some part of the establishment? I that wouldn't be my first guess, but I don't think that we can dismiss it. I mean, when everybody was saying that Trump is laying down a law for Netanyahu over the summer, I was very skeptical of this. But if you look at the timeline, it is interesting how Musk and Schumer chimed in when they did. Now, right now, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirator, is living a quite cushy life at what's called Club Fed, and seems to be in line for a pardon from Trump. So it seems to be very much a case of one hand scratches the other, or one hand touches the other. That is that Maxwell may well have dirt on Trump, and that in return for her silence, he's ensuring that she gets cushy treatment and eventually gets a full-fledged pardon for her crimes. So that's, I think, some of the dynamics that are going on here.
And well, we're speaking with Sam Husseini. Every week we do what we call Genocide Watch, and it's focusing on Gaza and the West Bank as we see that while there is some form of a ceasefire, the Israeli vision of surrounding, undermining, and continuing to control through heavy weaponry supplied by the United States is continuing apace. It is interesting that the structural support, secret support and overt support for Israel has been going on for years. I'm noting that at one point, I wonder why I think it's been reported that a Israeli spy or spies stayed for weeks or months at Epstein's apartment in Manhattan. What could that spy have been doing while they're hanging out with Epstein and whoever else is coming through that situation?
Well, it's really not clear from the Drop Site News report. It is a fascinating report on this spy who stayed at a facility by Epstein's, not the main one, apparently, and who was taken. He's sort of a protege of Barack. So what we have are the emails between Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister, and Epstein describing Epstein's interactions with this Mossad asset. And they're very cryptic. It's exactly the way that mobsters talk. It's like, be sure to tell him to return the earplugs that I, or the earpiece that I bought at the Mac store on 86th Street. It seems to be a code that they're talking about getting this Israeli spy to do various things. We don't know what they're actually talking about. We don't know what this code means, but it's quite clearly a code that they're giving direction to do something for some obviously nefarious purpose, because they're speaking in this code. And one footnote on this whole thing, part of the reason that they seem to be speaking in this code is that according to the documents leaked by Edward Snowden, you know, after this interaction happened, this whole interaction happened a little over 10 years ago, there seemed to be a concerted effort from parts of the NSA to be spying on Israeli assets. So it seems that they were, you know, very sensitive to the fact that the NSA might be spying on them, and that accounts for part of it. So we really don't know what's going on here, but we do know that quite clearly that Epstein is either an Israeli asset or somebody who's actually giving direction to Israel at a very, very high level.
You don't let spies in your living room. You don't have spies. Everybody doesn't have spies in their living room for months at a time without a structural governmental connection. And clearly, the Israelis would be wise enough to know, given the situation that where the spies were staying, that they would be, the Americans would be very vulnerable just in case there was some breakdown between the Israelis and the Americans. This gives the Israelis a lot of power to control U.S. policy for their own good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at certain levels, the U.S. and Israeli establishments are very much, work completely hand in hand. But there are, quote unquote, Boy Scouts within some parts of the U.S. government that might actually say, hey, Israel's breaking the law here. I'm going to do something about it. So I think that there's some sensitivity to that in terms of how parts of the, parts of the interaction between the two governments.
And just maybe just to put a bit of a fine point on it, the fact that it's Trump and Clinton are the ones with the most access or have the most experience with the child rapist, it would, it would seem to me that that would also be make it very clear that it's sort of a bipartisan policy at a lot of different levels. And it was at the time Clinton was trying to distract his own problems around Monica Lewinsky. So I believe one of the things that Clinton was busy doing, was he may have been disrespecting women. We don't know his relationship with Epstein, but we know that Clinton murdered Leila Al-Hatir this was a famous Iraqi artist, because Clinton was trying to distract from his problems on the domestic front and killed this incredibly famous artist from Iraq who was celebrated around the world. I just bring this up because all of it is sort of it's deadly, it's disgusting, and it shows an extraordinary amount of racism and sexism in the context of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, there are many aspects to this, but you bring up the Lewinsky thing. The subtext here is, one question was, what's the connection to Israel here? And the other question was, how much are we talking about blackmail being a factor here? And there's some evidence that in the Lewinsky the Times of Israel reported back in 2014 that Israel attempted to use tapes of former U.S. President Steen conversations with intern Monica Lewinsky to leverage the release of Jonathan Pollard. Others, wondered, if that had that was also leveraged because Israel was apparently spying on Clinton and knew about the Lewinsky scandal before everybody else did, and were they attempting to leverage it for
yes.
that? And you did.
Right.
You did have Clinton continuously. He bombed the Sudan and he bombed Iraq. His impeachment, trials and tribulations. So was that an attempt at a distraction, or was he sort of almost paying off part of the establishment to do the bidding of the establishment to such an extent that they would acquiesce to his continuing to stay in power? I think one could hypothesize both ways. We're interestingly enough now seeing Trump harangue the Israeli president Herzog about pardoning Netanyahu. so that he can, you know, hit all of his crimes seem, you know, in that what they're talking about pardoning. They're not talking about pardoning him for genocide and so on. They're talking about pardoning him for his financial crimes. But he's proven himself so useful to the U.S.-Israeli empire, having successfully committed so much carnage, that it's almost like Trump and Adelson and so on, you know, want to really help out the Bibi Netanyahu because he's done so much to advance Israel's imperial project. So,
Sam Husseini, opinions are those of the speakers. Sorry, I had to excerpt it. I shouldn't have been going off on Ken Burns and his dramatization of the revolution without analysis, which is what I'm predicting. Opinions, I already did that. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. It's time for another underwriting announcement, and then Radio Free Labor, which I enjoyed participating in last week, but I'm off to recuperate. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourself. And the IMC's got an event going on for black authors around town. So I understand from Gus that it's a lot of people hanging out and talking.